Thanks very much. Yeah, it's a great program. Thanks everyone for coming. This has been really enjoyable already for the last couple of weeks, and I look forward to the next almost two weeks. Okay, so today I said I'm going to talk about thermodynamics beyond the recoupling limit, but I've changed it a bit, and really I'm going to talk about different aspects of the work that we've been doing on thermodynamics beyond the classical macroscopic limit. So thinking about quantum coherences, correlations, and now lately about strong coupling. I'll start with a talk with slides, and then after the coffee break, Harry, who will talk about the thermodynamic uncertainty relation in more detail. So I'll introduce the setting, and he'll be able to go through the mathematical detail on the board. Okay, yeah, so maybe to point out Exeter is there. We are sailing slowly away, but you know, who knows what's going to happen next. So yeah. Okay, so let me start. So the outline will be this. So I'll talk a little bit about work from quantum coherences, because I've noticed that not everybody knew that older paper of our group, and I think it's really, really useful to know about this, so I'll talk a little bit about this. And then I'll talk about thermodynamics of correlations a little bit. The third point is then going to be about the recoupling limit, so going beyond the recoupling limit into the strong coupling regime, and that will then nicely lead into Harry's description of the thermodynamic uncertainty relation. Okay, right, let's start with the first, work from quantum coherences. So what's the setting? Well, the old-fashioned setting was about classical thermodynamics and the link between information theory and thermodynamics, and that goes back to Landauer, and you are all familiar with this. I'll just remind you of it. So what Landauer said is that the classical information process of erasure, of taking some state rho and mapping it to the blank state zero, can be understood thermodynamically. That's what he said. And so the picture is this. So you have your system, which is maybe initially in the state rho, and you want to bring it into a state zero. And to do that, you will have to put in some work, and the system will dissipate heat into the environment. And the environment is the thing that has a temperature T. And what Landauer showed is that the dissipated heat that the system dissipates to the reservoir here is KBT log 2, right? So if rho is a bit of information, then the entropy of this will be log 2. In general, that could be just the Shannon entropy of rho for a classical state rho. So that's what Landauer sort of argued. And well, this was a classical picture. So this was about classical information and erasing classical information. Now the question is, what's quantum? So how do we go into the quantum regime? And the main point about it, in my view, is that there is coherences. So what do we mean by that? So if you think of an initial state, rho, and now we think of an observable O. Yes, come in. Yeah, no, I didn't know too. It's quite warm as well, is it?
Yes.
Right. So it's small, dark, and warm. That's not ideal.
Yeah, maybe
is there? I closed it because it was noisy outside. Someone is lawn mowing. But yeah. There's no aircon in here, is there? Okay, so I want to talk about such processes that I call projection here, and they are about the state transfer of a state rho to a state eta. And what's eta? Eta is the state simply of rho that's been projected into some basis. So these are the projectors here. And so these projectors could be the eigenprojectors of some observable O. So for example, it could be the Hamiltonian. This could be the Hamiltonian, and then the pi's here would be the projectors onto the energy eigenstates. And so we're talking about a state transfer of rho to eta, okay? And the main point of that is, of course, that this state can have coherences in the energy basis before the projection process, and after the projection process, these coherences are gone. So that's the whole point of setting it up like that, because this does something that you couldn't, classically, there would be absolutely no difference between rho and eta, but quantumly, that's a big difference. So this is why these projections are interesting. Okay, so what can we learn? So, I mean, you all know about this, but what we are talking about here is that, for example, if you start with an energy superposition of energy states and your density matrix looks like this, and you go then to the state eta, this is the one where the off diagonals here have been removed. So that's what this process does. And what one can show really easily, come in.
Where were you hiding?
I'm sorry, I also didn't know. I came late too. Right, so what one can show really easily is that the optimal implementation of the transfer from rho to eta, one can extract work, okay? So it's different from Landau's principle where you have to put in work to do an erasure. Here you can extract work. And the maximum work you can extract is given by this entropy change here. And that entropy change is positive if the initial state rho has coherences, okay? So you can get work from coherences when you look at this type of process. And this was assuming that the projection basis is the energy basis, but you can also do it for a general projection, and then you will get an energetic change as well and will change the overall work. So maybe interesting is, so I'm happy to discuss a bit, so because everyone is very sleepy, this is a very small room. Please wake up and talk with me. So I think this is this is an opposite view of ergotropy, right? Ergotropy is about doing unitaries, keeping an entropy constant, and thinking about how much work you can get out. This is the opposite. Here, definitely the entropy changes. Actually, what doesn't change is the energy. The energy is constant in this process, as we will see in a second. So the entropy changes, the energy doesn't. Okay, so so actually the more important question is, how do you do such a transfer? So we want to go from rho to eta, and in thermodynamics, as we all know, it's about processes, right? It's not about the end states, it's about how you get from one thing to the other thing. And so the question is, how do you do it in an optimal way so that you get most work out? Yes?
This is that I'm trying to wake up.
Yes, me too.
what is the definition of work in this work from projection
yes.
thing?
That's a good question. So, actually, there is, in a way, I'm not going to specify any definition, but we'll talk about it in a second. There will be, we'll get there. There will be no microscopic definition of work in this picture. There's only an average work in this picture. Let me get to it. Okay, so what I'm talking about is we want to go from that state rho that has coherences to some state eta that where the coherences have been removed, and the question is, how do you do it? Well, the simplest way of doing this is to basically do decoherence, right? Decoherence happens automatically. You take your system, you put it in an environment. The system interacts with the environment in an uncontrolled fashion for a long enough time, and what it does is it removes coherences and the state decoheres. And that's it. Have you extracted work without definition, right? No, right? Because it's been a decoherence process. You haven't done anything to get work out of this system. So this is, no work has been extracted, but this was simply a non-optimal process, right? We're talking about thermodynamics, so you have to think about how do you do a process in an optimal way. So what is the optimal implementation of such a thermodynamic, of this transfer in a thermodynamic setting? And so the way I think about it is like the system can be a spin like this one here that can be controlled by external, say, coils that make a magnetic field. And that's how you put in work, roughly speaking. And there may also be a heat bath, which is the environment. And you will also try to have some sort of work storage system in which you extract your work. So that's the sort of thinking we have. And the question is, how can you do it optimally? Okay. Right, so the optimal way of doing it is this. And I think it's actually the most important part. It's a little bit technical, but it's quite interesting. So I go through it slowly. So let's take a qubit. So the qubit starts initially with a Bloch vector here in the Bloch sphere. This is the ground state, and excited state is at this pole. So this initial state has coherences in the energy basis. And what we want to achieve is we want to map this Bloch vector onto the Bloch vector that points in the direction of the energy basis. We want to remove coherences, right? That's the point. And that's simply a projection in the Bloch sphere. But the point now is, how do you do it thermodynamically? Mathematically, it's obvious how to do it. Thermodynamically, it's not completely obvious. It's also easy, though. So what you do is you first, so this is a spin, right? So a spin that sits in the magnetic field, say. So the magnetic field at the beginning is maybe B0, okay? So what you do first is you rotate your spin up there. That's a unitary operation, and you can do that by applying a pulse, a magnetic field pulse in this direction that rotates the spin like that. So this has to be done very quickly because we're thinking of that spin being in an environment of other spins and other stuff around. But if you do it really quickly, we can think about it as the spin is actually decoupled from the environment and actually goes unitarily up there. And so that would be something that I would call no heat, okay? All the change of energy is work, okay? Right, after we've done this, now actually the state is classical in a sense of it's already diagonal in the energy basis. All we need to do is change the length of that vector in this basis. And this can be done by, okay, I forgot something else. So after the unitary, we stop here. So this is the state of the spin, and we still have a magnetic field B0. What we do next is we adjust this magnetic field to some value B1, and the choice of that field is such that we choose the field such that the spin state is thermal, okay, with respect to the environment temperature. So this spin sits in an environment. The environment has a temperature. Once we've turned it up, it's diagonal in the energy basis, but the populations in the energy basis are non-thermal, non-Boltzmann. But we can choose our magnetic field such that they become thermal. And that's what we do here. So we change our B field such that actually the state is thermal now, even though we haven't talked to the bath yet, the reservoir. It's a quench, right? Yes.
I mean, initially it's a pure state, right?
Yes. Well, it's not actually pure here, but...
Okay. So it's already mixed.
Yeah, the initial state can be mixed, or it can be almost pure. When it's perfectly pure, it's a problem, because then you really cannot adjust it perfectly. But let's assume it's not perfectly pure, then it is actually easier. So then you can always find a magnetic field splitting such that the populations are thermal with respect to a given temperature.
The Hamiltonian is
given, right?
The
Hamiltonian is simply mu B, so this is the magnetic field, and then excited state minus ground state. So all we do is we change the B field such that the state of the spin, which is, what did I call it, rho 1, is e to the minus beta, that h, which depends on the B field, right? So you can always choose a B field such that this state is the thermal state. Okay, so once you've done this, so all of this has happened without touching the bath yet, I mean, without talking to the bath on a timescale very fast in comparison to talking to the bath. So all of this is still work, no heat. But now, at this point, we couple the spin to the bath. So we don't do anything. We simply wait. What happens is that the buff now actually thermalizes the spin, but it's already thermal, so nothing happens. And now you change, so to move the spin down, you simply change your B field very, very slowly, so that you're quasi-static, isothermal, and you move it to a magnetic field such that the thermal state corresponding to that magnetic field is a thermal state. Okay, so that state here is now a thermal state with respect to the final applied magnetic field B2. Simply quasi-static isothermal. Right, but we don't want to cheat. What we've done now is, of course, we've gone from a magnetic field that was B0 to one that is different. So if we do that, then of course we can always get sort of work out of that. So we want to sort of crank up the field to the original strength, because all we wanted to do was change the state, not the Hamiltonian. I mean, we did something in the middle, but we want to return to the initial one. So we put back the magnetic field in a very quick way, yeah, so that the state remains there during that time, but this is a quench again. So now it's a non-equilibrium state at the end of this process. Was that clear? Yeah, okay. So now.
But why do you need this last step? Usually you would end up and just do not, you know, if you want
to. Well, I want to go from rho to eta. But what I really mean is I want to go from rho, some initial Hamiltonian, to the same state. I mean, this state with the same Hamiltonian. So what I currently have is something else. I got some different Hamiltonian. So I don't want to have that. I want to have that. So that's why I need to readjust the B field. And that, of course, brings this state out of equilibrium, because that's now not the right splitting. But that's OK. OK, so that's.
But yeah. It's also a different direction, no? So
this B0 is back to the original. In this picture, B is always assumed to be up. There's no change of direction with B. Apart from this pulse needs to go like this so that you can unitarily turn.
But yes? I think in this last step, when you increase when you disquench, the state will remain the same because the Hamiltonian.
Yes, yes. And it needs to do.
Okay.
So just to be clear, so this state doesn't change during the quench of the magnetic field, but what happens during that change is that we readjust the magnetic field to return to the original Hamiltonian, so that we can talk about a state transfer without having to talk about a Hamiltonian at the same time.
Again, at time T3, what is the state of the system?
It's eta.
It's still the red arrow.
Yeah.
So you don't try to do a cycle. You don't go back.
No, I do not do a cycle. Very important. This is just really like Landau, a state transfer from one state to another state. And the states are rho and eta. Yes?
I think is it to decouple and couple to the thermal environment?
But that depends on the experiment, right? So I believe it can be done. I mean, this is what people do. Even in NMR experiments, they do these type of pulses, right? They couple. So I think that's what they do. To what precision and how much that will affect this picture, I don't know. Yes?
I don't really understand this coupling to the bath and going slow business.
Okay.
As your state is diagonal.
Yes.
In some Hamiltonian, and you do not change the eigenvectors of this Hamiltonian anymore, but only the eigenvalues. And
yes, it's classical.
I
mean, then you are in the classical thermodynamics realm, right? So if you go fast.
Just like this. You can go as fast as you want.
Well, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to maximize the work that you get out, you can't do what you want to do.
I'm just talking about the adiabatical following thing. Where this adiabatical following happens if you go slow. It's only true if actually, with respect to some basis, the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian change.
You are talking about quantum adiabatic. Right? Let me just and then.
It's different. It's not adiabatic.
This is not adiabatic. This is quasi-static isothermal. Isothermal, it's always in equilibrium at temperature T. but you change what the Hamiltonian is. So the state in because it's the optimum. It gives you the optimum work. It's like Carnot process, right? You do it the Carnot way because it gives you the optimum work.
I think if you go on your timeline,
yes.
Sometime after T1 that you didn't mark, your blue line hits sort of the height of B that you had initially and that you will have eventually. Mm-hmm. So yeah, over there. I think from there on, nothing happens. Whatever you do behind this.
Okay, I don't agree, but let's talk about it afterwards. So this is a completely classical picture here of just isothermally changing. I mean, it's really what you learn in second year. So there's nothing magic about this at all. Right.
I think I'm confused about the same
okay.
point. So
okay, let's point
that out.
Yeah. Really? Okay, so
I'm confused about the confusion.
Okay. Let's go through it slowly again. So so what's the issue?
Okay.
What sets the choice of B2?
Okay. This one?
Earlier, is there a special choice of that value there?
That is the choice that gives you that state. Okay, so which part would you like me to go through? So the first part of unitary rotation, everyone is clear? Okay.
No, it's not clear how there are enormous resources needed to prepare and know this initial state. And this
yes.
is much more work of orders of magnitude
yes.
more than this extraction you are talking about.
It depends on the question. It's true, you're completely right. You have to know what state you have to be able to manipulate it in the way I'm describing it. That's completely correct. Okay. Right, so the unitary part was clear.
And it's not adiabatic. That first unitary has nothing to do with adiabaticity. It's just a unitary fast.
It's just
right?
a unitary fast, really easy. So that was the unitary. The next thing was this adjustment of the B field, which was such to make the thermal the population thermal. That was clear? No. Do this if it's not clear. Okay, good. So the next bit is really the quasi-static isothermal change. So we'll talk about this now, right? So at the end of that step, we had a state rho 1 and a Hamiltonian H1. That is at the end of this step, so we are here, and this state is thermal. So that's what this means, and thermal is with respect to a temperature, inverse temperature beta. I write it like that. So this
and with respect to H1.
With respect to H1.
Rho 1 is e to the minus beta H1.
That's exactly right. So this is e to the minus beta H1 over Z1. And H1 is the one that has B1 as the B field. All my H's, all the H's throughout are simply B, and then, so all the changes is the energy eigenvalue, not the basis in which this Hamiltonian is diagonal. Okay, so this is our starting point, and we want to go to, sorry, I made this shorter, so we want to go to a state that's eta. This is our desired state, and we adjust our Hamiltonian H2 such that this is again a thermal configuration, which means again that eta is equal to E minus beta H2 Z2.
At all times during the process, right?
What do you mean, at all times?
So you adjust, then, maybe I'm skipping a step, but you connect the system back and quasi-statically decrease B field. You haven't got to that yet?
I have only said what the boundary conditions are.
Yeah.
So this is what we want to achieve. And now the question is, how do we go from there to there?
And I'm sorry.
Yes.
And H2 is determined by what conditions?
H2 is determined by, so eta is fixed. Eta is the...
Tell me again. What
yes. Eta is the state that you get when you take the initial state rho,
okay.
The very initial one there, and you project it on the energy basis.
Okay. And the initial rho is arbitrary.
The initial rho is arbitrary, any state, but we are particularly interested in states that have coherences.
Right.
So this state is given, and we know it. Eta is then fixed because it's the projection onto the energy basis. And so that fixes our H2, the magnetic field here, because that's the field that we have to choose such that this state is thermal with respect to that Hamiltonian. Right, so and just to write it again, so eta is defined as this, where these guys are the projections onto the energy eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian, which in my case here is always, the basis is constant, so that doesn't change in time anyway. So that's the definition. So far, so good? Okay. So now what's the question of how do we go from there to there? And so this is the point where John says at all times, right? The point is it's thermal at all times. So in the intermediate place here, so rho changes is a function of time, but at all times it's e to the minus beta h, which is the h that we, so we change the magnetic field here in time very slowly. That's what this means. And so the Hamiltonian changes very slowly, and the state follows it, and it's always thermal with respect to that Hamiltonian.
So this is the only step you have an entropic change, right?
Yes.
So this is when they actually consider work.
There will be work.
So it's not just the pair that somehow gives the work. It's the
of
process.
Course not. The process matters. That's what I'm saying. Yes.
Okay, because initially you said something like it's only going to be average and only depend on the time and the initial pair.
Wait, no, wait.
No.
In step two, it just so happens because you begin and end in terminal states that actually there is no path dependence, right?
Okay.
Because that's like a standard thermodynamic step. You can just.
Let me just answer Jochen's question first. So the point is we want to do this desired state transfer from rho to eta. That's fixed. We want to do that. And what I'm saying is it depends on how you do that process of how much work you will get. When you do decoherence, you do that transfer, but you get no work. That's not so great. So the question is, can you do it differently to get the maximum amount of work out? And that's what I'm describing here. So it is what I'm outlining here is the optimum process. You can do it less well, then you get less work.
Yes, I think I don't really understand as long as I do not know what is actually optimized.
Okay,
it's optimal, but.
I'll explain it afterwards, I think. John, did you have a question?
I was just saying that, look, just to clear the moments, 0 to 1, you're unitary. Then you have another unitary step where you adjust the B field to go to thermal state. There is no entropic change.
Yes.
Step 2 is unusual, right, because you're going from a thermal state at temperature beta to another thermal state at temperature beta with a different Hamiltonian.
Actually, it's not at all unusual, at
no,
all.
No, the point is that
it's
there's no, there,
classical,
that's not a process that
quasi-static, isothermal, I don't know.
So this statement that the thermodynamics depends on the path is not important in step 2, because
it is,
beginning
because
and ending in thermal states, so you can just use standard thermodynamic argument, right?
No, but you have to go quasi-statically through it to get the maximum work.
I mean, as long as you're connected to the... No, I know, but the fact that you're quasi-static means that you don't have...
Well, it would be the free energy of the
exactly.
Initial point the
exactly.
I know, mathematically that's what it is, but thermodynamically speaking, it very much matters of how you do it. So it's not just about the endpoints. I agree, it's the free energy in the end. It's all very simple when you do the maths. It's three lines. But understanding what you actually have to do seems to cause quite a lot of confusion. This is Carnot cycle. This is about, you know, when you go through the Carnot cycle, you have adiabats and isotherms, right? This is an isotherm. This is just changing. It's an isotherm.
The point I'm trying to make is, so in this isotherm, because now you draw a straight line.
Yes.
And then you define one. If you would make another line and also go very slowly, you would get the same amount of work.
What do you mean? What another line?
Changing, right? I mean, this.
Oh, you mean I don't have to go linearly?
Well,
yeah, sure.
That's all I meant. I mean,
okay. Yes, but the point is you have to go very slowly.
Yeah.
If you go very slowly, you're always in equilibrium. It doesn't matter how you get from there to there, but you have to always do it very slowly. And so the speed is what I focus on. The process is determined by the speed. So if you do it very fast, you will be out of equilibrium and you will start producing irreversible entropy, which will reduce your work.
Yes.
So that's not allowed. Okay, but let's move on now. So this part... So is everybody happy, more or less, apart from Jochen, that we can go from here to there? by a couple of sort of thermodynamic steps, yeah? Okay, so now let's do the energy analysis of this. So the first process, right, the unitary and the quench, it was isolated. The system was isolated from the environment. It didn't couple. So we say that the, and so this is my work definition, okay? I simply say that the work, the average work, I don't say what I'm averaging over, but simply the average work, is the energy change. So it's the initial energy and the final energy with the right sign. Okay? Because there's no heat in this process. Next part, that was the isothermal quasi-static process, the classical one. And here, of course, in the optimal case, the work that you get out is indeed just the free energy difference. Okay?
Your free energy is just U minus TS.
Yes. In this case, actually, this is all thermal. So there's not even a discussion about non-equilibrium free energies. This is all thermal. Okay. And the last step now, the third one where we quench the Hamiltonian back to the original value. Again, this is something where the system is isolated. And so, again, there's no heat. And so the energy changes the work. Okay? And if you add these three components up, you get indeed what I promised. So I'm just showing you that you can actually do it in a reasonable way. That's all. Okay? So you get what I promised, yeah.
Why did you say that you don't say what are you averaging if you take the trace?
Well, because I don't need it. In this analysis, you don't need to talk about fluctuating quantities and all that stuff. But you can. So this is actually what I, Alexia, when she was here, and we had a smaller meeting with some other people where we discussed how you can actually get this from a trajectory picture. So you can unfold the underlying fluctuating work and get the averages out like this. And you can then also include errors. Okay, I move on. So let me just summarize. So a quantum system in any state rho with coherences in the energy basis can be brought into a state eta, where these coherences have been removed by realizable thermodynamic steps. No change of energy expectation value occurs. That's important. I mean, the setup was such that we project into the energy basis. That means that energetically nothing has happened. But the quantum entropy of the state is modified. So the S eta is not equal to S rho, right? And actually the work that is extracted, you can say that this work is extracted from this entropic change, right?
And this is the only entropic change is the isotherm. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. But overall, let me just remind you, the isotherm is classical.
Yeah.
But the work is only, you can only extract work when you have coherences. So saying that, right? So do you know what I mean? So just making it sound as if it's the classical process that actually gives you the work is the wrong way of thinking about it. You are doing a whole process. Anyway, so overall, I would say that work can be extracted from both, right? If you have a non-equilibrium state in general, you can extract it from energy populations that are non-thermal. That's the classical way of extracting work. You have non-Boltzmann weights, you do something to them, you bring it to equilibrium, and by doing that, you extract work. But in addition, you can also get work from energetic superpositions, and that's what we just discussed. That's all. So two aspects. Okay. Yes.
So maybe you said this, but I arrived on the question. Sorry for this one. That this energy extraction, how does it compare with the ergotropy of the initial?
Yes, I did mention it. So ergotropy is almost the opposite of this. So ergotropy is something that you do under unitaries, right? How much work can you get under unitaries? That means that the entropy doesn't change.
Yeah.
So you get the work from energy. This is the opposite. Here, the energy is fixed. What changes is the entropy. It's not the same. It's really not comparable. So it's comparing apples and oranges.
Sorry.
Yes.
Just another comment regarding this. So I think if you would consider the bath explicitly, so you would have another quantum system, and then you would look at the ergotropy of the two things together. Then you would recover these, so it would be a way of putting the two things.
Okay, yes. Yes, if you think of everything together and do it unitarily and then you trace, then you may be able to connect it, yes. But I mean, I think the simplest way of understanding it is it's two different sort of things. I mean, one of them keeps the energy constant, one of them keeps the entropy constant. Yes.
Can you generalize like to larger systems or harmonic oscillators?
Oh yeah, that, all of this is general. So I mean,
oh, it's not the qubit.
It's not qubit, but I mean, you can always do all of this for any system, discrete actually. I'm not sure about continuous. I think the argument goes true for any discrete level system. Yeah.
But this assumption that somehow you can adjust the qubit state so that it has the same temperature as the bath might be dubious, no?
No,
in a more complex
system. I know what you're thinking. I think what you're thinking is that for a qubit, you can always find, because there's only two probabilities, and you can always make it thermal, right? But I allow the change of the Hamiltonian's eigenvalue structure, right? Which means that any discrete state that has any populations in the different energy eigenbases, I can adjust my energy eigenvalues in that basis just so that they are Boltzmann distributed for every level. Does that make sense?
Yeah, even if it's not sorted, no? Even if you have a large population.
Yeah, when it's not sorted, you have to do the unitary in a different direction. You have to do it such that you sort them correctly. Yeah.
Yeah, in more complex systems, perhaps you need more parameter than.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's going to get much more complicated, but it's going to be possible in theory. It's possible, but practically it will be very difficult, I think. Yes.
In what sense your work comes from coherence? At first sight, I would say here the work, so the energy that's been provided to the external field that is coupled to this object comes from the heat that we get from the bath. So here, if I look at it like this, thermodynamically, this energy going out from the bath, then going into your work source, which is somehow hidden in this time dependence.
I mean, that's always true. I agree. I think, I mean, you always, in thermodynamics, you always shift around energy between heat bits and work bits, right? I'm saying I'm doing this through coherences. So I'm moving heat into work by using coherences. That's why I say work from coherences. But you're right that energetically speaking, of course, the heat is getting transferred into work. Yeah, just like in Landau as well, like you move the other way, right? You put work in and you make it. You make it as it becomes dissipated heat, but you say it's the erasure of information that dissipates heat. Yes.
So what if you start at top of the green arrow?
Yes.
Because then you have no coherences.
Yes. But then, I mean, this is the way why it's important to set up the right question. it sounds ridiculous, but I mean, if you think of Landauer. Again, so I mean, the whole point of why Landau is interesting is because it has a certain boundary condition that you want to achieve, and then you work out what it is that you get from that, right? So I've chosen one where the boundary condition is rho goes to eta, where rho has coherences and eta doesn't have coherences. So.
But the question of starting at the top of the green arrow is still valid because that's thermodynamically out of equilibrium.
Of course, but this is classical then, right? So.
Fair enough.
So then you're changing, I mean, also, it depends on what the Hamiltonian is, but basically you're back to a classical picture where you're changing energy and entropy, and you're doing it completely classically, and you get free energies and all that. So, yeah. Okay, I'll move on. This is taking much longer than I was anticipating. Right. So, briefly, let me comment on related results. So I mean, that what I said is, you know, you can get work from coherences, but this was in a non-cyclic process, right? Just transferring one state to another. The next question, of course, is, can you get work from coherence? Can work from coherences increase engine power? So, when you run somehow a cycle, can coherences increase the power? And of course, this has been shown to be the case by Ronnie and Ram and Amikam, right. So it's somehow related that there's also some benefit of running engines with coherences. Okay. another thing that came out roughly at the same time was, in a way, I would phrase it like this. So the question is, does work extraction from coherences require some special equipment to be able to do it, right? And the answer is yes, you sort of need a reference frame, right? Coherences are always with respect to something. So you need to have a reference frame to break superselection rules and keep track of coherences. So there is some equipment needed to be able to do this.
So this reference frame is the basis?
Yeah, you need to be able to know what the basis is, right? So, I mean, in optics, you have a laser pulse and you have a signal and an idler that are phase matched, so that you can talk about coherences with respect to that, reference. So that's important to have that. If you don't have that, you don't actually have coherences.
Janet?
Yes.
I wanted to remember that in those works where you have actually the weight, the has mm-hmm. to do something with the
yes.
weight. Then there is no way of exploiting these initial coherences in the energy eigenbases.
Oh, you mean the resource theory?
Yeah. Well, like the word.
I think I took that slide out, but okay. So.
You do like during. Yeah, the full energy distribution is not allowed to change and all of this. And
yes.
If you lift the weight, then...
Okay, I think if you refer to, say, the Horodetsky-Oppenheim paper and where they first introduced the...
Well, the paper by you and me.
Yes, okay, but that was afterwards. so...
But this is what I can understand.
Yes, but the assumption there is that actually in the original paper as well, so this was about resource theory, and it was about work extraction and the optimal work extraction. I do have a slide of this. I've erased it. Right. So, yeah. Briefly, they didn't consider states that have coherences. Didn't. So they just had diagonal states, and then they talked about the optimal work that you get. And then they said, if you do have coherences, what you do is you first decohere, and then you do their protocol of extracting work. From that point of view that I've just been talking about, this doesn't seem like a logical thing to do, because you are seemingly losing work that you could extract from coherences first, before you then do what they do. That's the brief answer.
Well, I don't completely agree.
So if you have a coherence in the way, then you can do it.
Yes. Okay.
Here we're not talking about coherence in the way, we're talking about coherence in the
source
system.
You have coherence in the state and the way has no coherence, or you have no external source of coherence. Then what you're saying is completely true. But if you have some source of coherence, like in the way, then you can use this to also extract the coherence in the system.
Okay. So there seem to be different definitions,
yes.
And according to different definitions and setups, it might be possible to get work in coherence, and in others, it's impossible, right?
So yeah, it depends on everything. It depends on your question, your tools, your everything. So, I can only talk about what I've done, and I've outlined exactly what the scenario is that I'm looking at. But in other scenarios, you can do different things, so, you know.
Yes,
the same words are used, but the assumptions,
I
agree.
No,
that makes it very confusing, yeah.
But in a way, I would say the definition would still be the same, the way going up, because that you need some extra resource, like to be some coherence or so. I wouldn't say it's completely different frameworks or different.
Okay, I would say that we continue this discussion in a coffee break. Let me try and move on. So let me just tell you very simply what the implications are, right? To show what I showed you mathematically, right? Not the thermodynamic steps, but just to show what the maximum work is, you need very little and it takes three lines, okay? And what you need is thermodynamics. So you need the first law that the energy change of the system is made up of heat and work, right? And you need the second law, which says the thermodynamic entropy change is bigger than than the heat absorbed, that type of thing. And in addition, you need the link between thermodynamics and information theory. So that is sort of, in my simple way of thinking about it, is it really just means that you can replace the thermodynamic entropy by first the Shannon entropy. That's what Landauer argued, right? But now we've replaced it with the von Neumann entropy, right? So that's another step which actually goes into the quantum case, right? So these are the assumptions I've made to prove that you get the maximum work. And so the conclusion was removing coherences can lead to work extraction, and the question is, can you actually experimentally see this? Okay, we don't know, right? So this is one of the things that I have arguments with different people. Some people say, yeah, of course you will get it, because it's already proven and there's nothing to find out. I don't see it this way, because I think we have absolutely no evidence so far that you can really replace the von Neumann entropy and use the von Neumann entropy as a thermodynamic entropy in any way, experimental proof. We have, of course, proved that quantum mechanics is correct in every aspect, but we never measure entropy. We don't have an entropy meter. So we do not have evidence that this is true, okay? So, so let me just say this. So if the experiment would say, no, you don't get this work, then that would imply that something here is wrong, right? It would imply either the thermodynamics is wrong in the quantum regime, so it could be that the laws are somehow different. I don't expect that. Or it could mean that the link is somehow not like this. So simplest case, for example, would be that the thermodynamic entropy is not equal to the von Neumann entropy, but, for example, it could be equal to the energy entropy. That's something I've invented. The energy entropy is take your state, first only look at the diagonal and the energy basis of that state, and take the Shannon entropy of this. Right? That's also an entropy, right?
That's what people call the diagonal entropy.
Diagonal. But energy, diagonal, right? So, I mean, if you did that, then the classical case would be identical, because classically it's the same. But the argument here would disappear, and you couldn't extract work from coherences, because you never have entropy from the coherences. So I think there's something to be found out. I think this is not a settled issue. Right, I'm not going to get any today here. So I'll just do a last bit that follows on from that work about correlations, and I think then we just go for the coffee break, and I guess we'll sort of see how we do that part. Right, so let me just briefly extend what we've been doing so far to not just a system on which we act, but the system is also coupled or correlated with some ancilla A. Okay, so if our initial state is rho as A, which is system and ancilla, and now we still do a projection just on the system, so it's as if you do the previous process and you don't know that there's an ancilla hanging on the system as well, but you just do exactly the same as before. Okay? So that state I call now eta as A, so it can still be correlated with the system in ancilla, can still be correlated. The question is, how much work can you get out now if you know that your system in ancilla are correlated and you can use that information? So the answer is like this. So the work that you get when you act on the system and on the ancilla together is the same as the optimal work for the system alone, the one that we already had, plus something that is a correlation function called delta here. And that correlation function is, it's the entropy of the initial state of the system. So that's the trace of this for the system. The full state of S and A. And these guys here are the state of the ancilla when the system has been projected into one of the eigenbases. So it's this thing here. Rho is A projected into the energy eigenbases trace. This is this. And then multiplied with the probability of this occurring. Okay, so this is the expression. And I'm not an expert in this, but Kavan for sure will recognize that. No? Okay. So it's related to the discord. So the discord is pretty much the same thing, but the discord is a measure of correlations where you have to optimize over all possible projections. here the projections are fixed. I want to project, say, in the energy basis, so I'm not optimizing. If the energy basis is the optimum one, then this is the discord. But if it's not the optimum one, then it's some other correlation issue. But the bottom line is, the most important bit is work. More work can be extracted from a correlated composite system SA than from S alone. So correlations are a resource for work extraction, obviously, as well. That was, of course, also the result of this paper here that probably most of you know of, Lydia and others, that sort of show that negative conditional entropy is also, you can also convert this into work, basically. So that's the same type of idea of correlations can help you extract work. In terms of accounting, I think there's also an issue to discuss. We can discuss this over coffee. I like to think of the system being the thing that we account things on. So the work and the heat and all that is something that I want to talk about for the system. Once we start having the system correlated with something else, I don't feel comfortable saying that we've extracted this work from the system, because really what we've extracted it from is from the system and the ancilla, and that's a very different story, and sort of the whole accounting sort of changes gear. So in that sense, I wouldn't, you know, more work when you compare it like this, of course, but you also have to have a lot more control. You're talking about a different system. And in that sense, I'm not sure whether it's helpful to really talk about work from correlations, because it simply means you're talking about a bigger system. You're changing scale, and I'm not sure you can compare it, but let's talk about it over coffee. Okay. I think I'll stop there, and we'll have coffee. And after the coffee, I'll just try to briefly go into the recoupling, and then Harry can go. Okay, thank you. Okay. Right, I'll continue now on a completely different thing. So this is a very different aspect that I'm going to try and focus on now. So let's call it beyond the weak coupling limit. Okay, so this is a picture of a macroscopic system, and for such systems, the coupling to the environment can normally be neglected. So the coupling between the system to the reservoir here is normally comparably small in comparison to the energy of the system itself. But for smaller scale systems, this coupling can become relevant. So this is the system, it's coupling to the reservoir, and in comparison now, the coupling here is going to be same size as the system Hamiltonian energies. Okay, so I mean, obviously I'm following on from what Philip already talked about last week, and I think Marty is also going to talk about in 2 days, right, about strong coupling. So I will keep it fairly short, but the main task, as Philip already outlined very nicely last week, is standard thermodynamics, like completely standard thermodynamics, makes always the weak coupling assumption, right? Everything we've learned in school and all that stuff always makes the assumption that you can treat your system as weakly interacting with the environment so that it can thermalize somehow. But that's it. After that's like it's thermalized, there's no more impact of the environment. But the question is, all of these laws of thermodynamics and all of the rules that we know, can they be extended to the case that this assumption is not true anymore? So, you know, the second law and the fluctuation relations and all these things, can you extend this to the case that the system is small, the interactions are not negligible, and what do you do then? Okay, that's the game. And so Philip already summarized a lot of the things that generally the research community has found. So a lot of things can be done. And the main point is that you have to include corrections in your thermodynamic description of such a system. And these corrections come from the interaction. So very briefly, because Harry will need this, So the sort of situation that mostly is being considered is this. So you have a Hamiltonian. This is written in a classical way with phase space coordinates here and force parameters, lambda. So you have some global Hamiltonian. it has a bare part on the system, it has a bare part on the bath or reservoir, and there's an interaction term. And so when you take a global thermostate of the system and the bath, like this, right, the point is that when you take then the reduced state of the system, it is not going to be a Gibbs state with respect to the bare Hamiltonian anymore when the interaction term is non-negligible. When it's negligible, then of course this reduced state will simply be a Gibbs state, but otherwise it isn't. And this is where you introduce a new Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian of mean force. It simply is defined as the thing with respect to which that reduced state of the system is Gibbsian. Okay? So this guy is an effective Hamiltonian here, mean force Hamiltonian, that has the bare Hamiltonian in it, but then it has a correction term, and that correction term arises basically from the interaction, which is there, and it also will depend on temperature, or inverse temperature beta. So that's very unusual. Normally in thermodynamics, Hamiltonians don't depend on temperature. They are separate things, temperature and energies. Now the Hamiltonian does depend on temperature, and that's why we can expect things to change in standard derivations. Okay, so this is what the Hamiltonian of mean force is. And I think I'm going to skip a lot of stuff. This is what Philip already talked about. You can define stochastic energies, entropies, free energies for such sort of systems. And so they are looking pretty much the same as before. This is classical. So this is basically the energy of a system along its trajectory. But then there's an additional term that comes from the interaction. And also the entropy, I think this is a very interesting thing to see that normally you take the entropy as log of the probability distribution, minus log. But here now you have an additional term that comes from the coupling. So what I'm saying is you can find thermodynamic potentials that are very similar to the standard thermodynamic potentials, but have additional correction terms that come from the interaction with the environment. And if you do it this way, then you get pretty much everything you want. So I think I'm going to skip all of this. But basically, you get extensivity, that your system and environment can be treated as you know, extensive objects as you want it in thermodynamics, standard thermodynamics. And you get all the other stuff. You get, for example, you can do trajectories. This is classical. So you can write down a Crookes relation, which relates the forwards probability distribution of entropy production with the negative, the time reversed bit. And you can then also find such a relation. OK, I'm just going to skip it. So the main point is you get the same thing as standard thermodynamics if you take into account the corrections correctly, okay? Right, I'll briefly go in the start of this. So this is what Harry's going to talk about in a minute. So the thermodynamic uncertainty relation is something that says, okay, so in quantum mechanics we have an uncertainty relation, right? X and P and stuff. But in thermodynamics there's also something called uncertainty relation that goes back to Bohr as well, apparently. And this is an uncertainty between energy and temperature, okay? So, I mean, the simplest way for me to understand this in the first place is to think of the microcanonical ensemble. If you think of the microcanonical ensemble, then your system is an ensemble of states that is all in one energy shell, right? So energy is fixed and sharp, but you have no temperature. There's no notion of temperature. So when
notion of temperature.
Okay. 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 Let's. Yeah, okay. Well, fine. So let's discuss about this. I don't understand this part yet. I'll learn. Right. But so the canonical ensemble sort of tries to lets the energy fluctuate. Right. So energy fluctuates. Delta U is not zero anymore. You have a notion of temperature. This is a parameter, so it should be sharp. But actually, the temperature will also be a parameter that you would have to estimate and measure. And when you measure it and try and estimate what the value of that parameter is, you will have uncertainty in that parameter. And so that's a sort of the meaning of that inequality. There is a trade-off between how much uncertainty you can have in these two things. Robert doesn't agree. Okay. Right. So one of the main things that I want to say to before Harry can start deriving this is the following. So in the weak coupling regime, in the normal standard thermodynamics regime, there are two things that we use a lot, and that's the Gibbs state, the thermostate, which is simply e to the minus beta h s with the bare Hamiltonian, and of course the energy, which is take that thermostate and take the same h s, and then you calculate the energy of the system, right? But in the strong coupling regime, first of all, the state changes to become thermal with respect to the Hamiltonian of mean force, okay? And the other thing that happens is that the energy here is now an expectation value of that same state with a different energy operator, okay? The two of them, so first of all, this here becomes different because of the corrections due to coupling, but this here also becomes different in a different way, okay? So you get two energy operators, really.
But, sorry, how do you find the energy if you have strong
coupling? So E, this E, so HS is already defined. It's the thing that makes the reduced state Gibbs. But this E I haven't defined yet. The E is the thing. So we still want to keep that definition, that US is, this is d beta log Z. And Z is now this Z. So if you take that Z and work out what US is, you will find that you cannot use HS star there to get the correct US, okay? That motivates that you have to choose something else. And the ES is then this. The ES is beta H star and then differential with respect to beta. So let's check the weak coupling limit. In the weak coupling limit, HS star becomes the bare Hamiltonian HS, independent of temperature. And d beta here applied to this is simply going to differentiate this, and you are just left with the bare Hamiltonian HS. So in the recoupling limit, this E becomes the bare Hamiltonian.
Is that now quantum or classical? Or
this is both. This is quantum and classical. Okay. Right. Okay, I think yes, how far should I go? So the energy operator is that, and now the question is, so this is an example that we've worked out for a damped harmonic oscillator. Yes, so here this is the actual Hamiltonian of mean force. So this is still a harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian, and what happens here is that the mass and the mass of the oscillator and the frequency become dependent on the temperature through the interaction with the bath. Okay, so they start to be rescaled, and you can also write down what this E star is. And E star is something that you can express as it's still H star times some alpha. So that part would be commuting, but there's an additional term, this term over here, which you can see that this is going to be not commuting with H star. You see what I mean? So this is really, really interesting because it means that the Gibbs state, which is Gibbs with respect to that Hamiltonian, the canonical state in this picture, is not commuting anymore with the energy operator. Okay? And that's a result of the strong interactions. So in that sense, the commuting, the non-commuting can only happen, of course, in the quantum case. But the effect only happens when you have strong coupling. So both of them have to come together, quantum and strong coupling. Okay, right. So back to this uncertainty relation. So we want to show this uncertainty relation, but with strong coupling. And to understand what delta beta is, you have to understand that you have to estimate this, and I'm not going to go through this. But the main point is that you then can derive something called the thermodynamic uncertainty relation at strong coupling, which you can write like this. So, you know, we've previously had delta beta times delta U, that is the standard thermodynamic uncertainty relation, and now it becomes delta beta is bigger than this, so here's delta U, right? If there's no Q, then this is the standard relation. But what you see now is that there is a Q, and that Q has to do with the non-commutativity of the canonical state with the energy operator. And it's something called the skew information. And
so,
I think,
sorry,
yes.
I was lost at some
point. Yeah, yeah, I know everyone is sleeping now.
Where did you have to define the reduced density matrix? Because you could simply proceed without defining any reduced density matrix. You just use, if your system is strongly coupled,
yes.
You use the density matrix for the full Hamiltonian, including also the,
yes.
Without any density matrix in the middle.
You mean you want to treat the whole the system,
yeah.
And the reservoir, all of it?
Yeah. So
yeah, that's possible. In principle, mm-hmm. It's possible, but that's not what we're talking about. We want to have the system coupled to the reservoir and still want to sort of see whether we can do thermodynamics just with the system.
Just for the system.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we reduce the state, but that state now is not Gibbs because of the correlations with the environment.
But, yeah, one thing is the evaluation, for instance, of the energy stored in your system.
Yeah.
But to define that, you can do that with the density matrix of the full system. So one thing is the average.
Uh-huh.
And another thing is the density.
Andrew, I'd like to remove
operator.
This now. Do you know how? You mean the energy?
Because you can still evaluate, for instance, your delta US,
yeah.
But these are mean values. And to evaluate those mean values, you can proceed with the full.
So the fundamental problem is this. You have a system and a bath that have a state rho, and that have a Hamiltonian H. But what we want is we want to just talk about the system state and the system Hamiltonian. Okay?
Yeah, but you want to talk about rho S, or you just want to talk about the energy stored in your S, in your system? Because there are different things.
Okay.
In order to evaluate the energy or any mean value of what you stored in your system, you can use the full density.
Of course. But I think the question is, what's the energy operator? So the thing is, we know how to. So let me just put some things on. So what we want is we want to have an effective description of the system, given that it interacts with the environment.
I agree.
Okay,
yes.
And then we have a description of how to get this reduced state. It's simply this one, right? Trace over that.
Yeah.
Right.
My question is.
The problem is this.
Necessary.
So I think what you're saying is you can take. You can still take this and take some H, and that's going to give you the energy.
Okay.
But that's not going to be right. So what I'm saying is, if HS is that bare Hamiltonian,
yeah.
This is not going to give you the right energy. Okay, this is not the right energy.
Which is not the right energy? The energy of the system?
Yeah, because it's
of
a question
system.
Of accounting.
It's
because
a question
you want
of
the
accounting.
If it's exactly. Strong coupling, you somehow have to, I would say, it boils down to the question, I'm interpreting
yeah.
You,
yeah.
That how to account for each yeah. Interaction.
Yes.
This is in a way, I would say, that.
The way to account for the. For the
H interaction.
H interaction is to include in rho.
No,
not enough.
To put everything.
Yeah, but
there.
when I say energy,
if
we coupling.
If you have Hamiltonian, you take into account everything.
Yeah, but then the question is, you want to partition it to the energy of the system, the energy of the bath. So you want to say how much energy does the system carry with it. So if it's weak coupling, you know it's only the bare Hamiltonian.
Exactly.
If it's strong coupling,
then what?
So then what? So this is a certain, I would say, choice.
It's a choice.
Of accounting. Which my accounting office may accept it, maybe not next
yes.
Year. The
so my accounting office, like so what we're saying is just to briefly summarize, and then Mark had a question. So what we're saying is that if you simply choose your bare Hamiltonian HS to be the thing that measures energy for the system, then you run into inconsistencies of the second law, which I've had to skip because I have no time. But this is the motivation of including additional terms. So you want to have correction terms that come from the fact that you have interactions.
No, I basically agree with that.
Okay.
I'm just saying that you don't need to introduce any reduced density.
Yes, I don't. this is actually the focus is on the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, but you want to do that to get the entropy.
Okay.
You so can use the full density operator of your taking into account density.
Okay, so the point is the Hamiltonian we're going to use for the system is this mean force Hamiltonian. Okay, this is a choice. Briefly on the choice, so the assumption we are working with here is that the magnitude of Hs is sort of comparable to the magnitude of Vint, but it's much, much smaller than the magnitude of Hb. So in other words, you can't take this approach for two qubits. Okay, two qubits. Not good. So if this is system and this is buff, this doesn't work because that's not the right thing then. But if this is really a huge buff and this is a system, then this is a reasonable approach, okay? Okay, Mark, did you have a question?
Yeah, I would have thought the answer depends on what you're going to measure and how you're going to measure.
I agree as well. Yes, absolutely. Okay, I think I'm going to stop now.
Okay, so I have another question.
Yes.
So a number of years ago, I wrote a paper with Karine Lavore where we sort of worked on the same kind of problem.
Uh-huh.
And we had kind of a different approach to it. And so one of the things we did is we said, when you reduce the system density matrix, you can think about the fact that it's in some thermal state because it's entangled with some bath, even though it's bathed in the thermal state. You can think about it as some kind of effective temperature of the system. And so our approach was to say, introduce some effective temperature of the system, and then try to see how this thermodynamic law is working.
Yes.
Have you thought about this kind of approach?
We haven't used this approach, but there are several other groups that have done this approach. For instance, Tony Asin's group has several papers on effective temperatures. And actually, what I remember from one of their papers, I don't have the reference, a few years ago, was that they were trying to. So they kept the Hamiltonian the same, something like this, like the state, the reduced state, they still want to have it. So this is fixed, but this one here can now vary.
Yeah,
okay?
That's exactly what we do.
And you can only approximately get this right,
yeah.
Not correct, perfectly. So the problem is then to optimize, find the optimal beta tilde that gets you as close as possible. Yeah, that's an alternative approach. I have no particular preference at the moment. My physical thinking about it is like this, right? I mean, if we're actually talking about this room that has a temperature, and you are here, right? So okay, well, that you are self-organized. This table is here, right? I still want to think of that table having the temperature of the whole thing. I don't want to think of that table having a different temperature from the room. So for that reason, I would like to keep the temperature fixed, but change the effective energetic description. But it depends, again, on the situation you're looking at.
But then it's weird because the effective energetic description also depends on the temperature in some weird way.
Yes.
So this is also kind of unsatisfying.
Just because I was in one of these papers.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I wasn't sure anymore.
One of the messages that what you can do, so you, in this picture that you wrote, you could take a boundary of your system.
Uh-huh.
Slightly bigger. And then what you see is that this reduced state is very well described by a thermal state of system plus boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like an effective way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now? Okay. Yeah? Okay. So Harry's going to now talk about the uncertainty relation in a little bit more detail. I guess I give this to you.
If we're done with the projector, can you turn this off?
Yes.
Blending
very bright.
Okay, so I'm going to sort of give you another separate thing to talk about. I know we've had a lot of things here, but so I'm going to link three things together. I'll get back to this strong coupling stuff in a minute. So I'm going to be talking about something called the Wigner-Yanassi skew information. So I'm going to link this to strong coupling. going to show how this leads into this thermodynamic uncertainty relation linked to hopefully I've got enough time to get through all of this stuff. Okay, so has anyone heard of this before, this Bigley massive cube emission? Okay, I'll talk about that. So this was introduced in the 60s by Fichtner and Unazzi as a way of quantifying the quantum uncertainty in an observable. So they were thinking along the lines of, suppose we have a pure state and some observable A. Now, normally the uncertainty in this would just be, you know, the variance in this observable. But then what they were concerned with was, suppose we have a mixed state, a general mixed state, how do we quantify the uncertainty in this observable, but only due to the quantum contributions to the state? So can we split this variance into a quantum part and a classical part? So what they defined as a quantum uncertainty measure is to satisfy three things. So firstly, you want these two things to be positive. You want the variance of this to be equal to the quantum part if this is pure. So, and the last condition is you want the quantum measure to decrease under mixing. So in other words, if you take a classical mixture of states, you shouldn't be able to increase the quantum uncertainty by taking a convex combination of states. So just sort of formally, so whatever this measure is, if we take a classical mixture of states, this should decrease, right? So so there's no unique way of doing this. So you know, it's a bit abstract because there's an infinite number of ways you could measure such a quantity, but I'm going to sort of argue for a specific quantity that shows up directly in strong coupling thermodynamics. So what they proposed as an actual choice of this function is the following. So this is the thing that they call, you know, the skew information.
Sorry, what is p sub I again, a little p?
Just probabilities.
Of what?
So just if you take if you have a set of states, just take a convex combination of
just any weighting then.
Yeah, any normalized weighting, yeah. So this thing is defined through the commutators between the mixed state and the observable. So. Okay, and this parameter A can sit between 0 and 1. So they originally proved that this thing satisfies these three conditions for alpha equals 1/2, and then it was Lieb in the 70s with his concavity theorem finally proved that this thing is it satisfies this convexity for classical mixtures. So the quantity I'm going to be talking about is slightly different to this. So there's this arbitrary dependence on alpha. We can define, I'll put it here. So the quantity I'm going to be talking about is an average over this alpha. we just take the integral over all of these parameters. So yeah, again, this seems like an arbitrary choice, but it turns out that this thing shows up exactly in thermodynamics, which is the interesting thing. So part two, strong coupling. So I'll just recap what Jana was talking about. So we have some Hamiltonian of a system above, and we assume everything's in canonical equilibrium, so the reduced state of the system is going to be this thing that we had before, so this mean force Hamiltonian. Okay. So this thing is just so what Janet was talking about was this energy operator is not equivalent to this Hamiltonian. So the energy of our system, remember, is given by this partition function that we have, this effective partition function. And this is equivalent to the total energy of this whole thing minus the energy of the bare reservoir, bare bath. So it kind of makes intuitive sense. So we're attributing the energy of the strongly coupled system to the energy you need to immerse it in the composite state. So we subtract the bare energy from everything.
So how's that defined?
Sorry?
How do you define the bare energy?
Ah, okay, so this is just... So the bath without any coupling, and its average of its energy, right? Like this. So of course, if the interaction is small compared to the Hamiltonian of the bath, then the reservoir is going to be approximately in this state, and so it's kind of natural to subtract this energy off. So what we were talking about was we want to introduce an operator which describes this, because this is an average quantity. So if we want to talk about fluctuations in the energy, introduce an operator. So this is the thing that we had before. So it turns out that this average is given by this thing. So in other words, yeah, it's just the trace of this. So it's kind of surprising because you might expect, so this mean force Hamiltonian is really used just to give you the partition function, but it doesn't.
So what is E sub S now? Is this something different from the system Hamiltonian?
Yeah. It's different from both the bare one and the mean force one. But this is the thing that actually describes the eigenstates of energy in the strongly coupled system.
I'm just trying to make sure that the mean force is this H star.
Yes, this is...
You have a name for this thing and the other thing?
Effective energy operator, I guess.
So if I take just the bare Hamiltonian, the total Hamiltonian, system bath coupling bath, I take its expectation value in a full many-body state, I get three terms. So is E S star accounts for both energy and coupling energy?
Yes. So this accounts for the difference between the total energy. Yeah.
So you're lumping in the interaction energy with the system.
I'm minusing the energy of the reservoir in the absence of the interaction.
The system with a captain minus the ship.
If I may, except it contains also information about the bath. Not only the interaction.
Yes.
It's USB. It's USB minus U. So this operator in fact contains information about the full Hamiltonian, not only system and interaction.
Because you can't separate them.
It's a global kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because you're only subtracting the uncoupled bath expectation.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is some residual back.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Yeah. Right, so, okay, so this, so the key point is that in general, if this interaction is not, does not commute with these bare Hamiltonians, then the system is actually going to have a set of coherences with respect to energy, at least energy measured through this operator. So they don't commute because, you know, you're taking the derivative of this temperature-dependent thing, and it's just going to be a complicated mixture of operators. So what we're actually going to see is that this non-commutativity can be quantified through this skew information, and it shows up quite naturally in thermodynamics. And the way it shows up is through the heat capacity. So I'll come over to here. So let's look at the heat capacity. So this is just the defined as the rate of change of the this average energy we have over here. So with temperature. So normally in the weak coupling case, we know that this is equivalent to the fluctuations in energy, right? So for weak coupling, CS is going to be equal to the variance in energy of the V squared. Well, I guess we've said Boltzmann constant but we get something interesting in the strong coupling case. So we get corrections to this relation. So here's the main point that I'm trying to show you. So in the strong coupling case, we find that the heat capacity is given by the variance in energy for this thing over here minus the skew information with respect to this operator plus an extra dissipation term. Okay, so we get two corrections, two additional terms. So this, of course, is measuring the fact that we have coherences in energy in the strong coupling case. And this term is actually a classical correction term. So this remains even if the interaction and everything commutes. So it stems from the fact that the energy operator is going to depend on the temperature of the bath around it. So how do we get this? Well, I'll just show you like a few steps. So the first thing is we can write this difference here as an integral. So this is just the operator minus its average. Okay, so it's just this is just ES star minus average energy. So the reason that we can connect we have this funny integral here, and the reason that this connects to the thermodynamics is the following. So if you differentiate an exponential operator. So say we have some parameter here, which in our case will be temperature, and some operator that depends on this. This turns into an integral like this. So you can kind of see how this fits together. So we're going to be differentiating when we evaluate the heat capacity, we take the derivative of essentially this exponential up here. And because this depends on temperature, we get the energy operator fits down here. So yeah, I'm not going to go through the exact steps, but you can kind of see why these two things link together.
So for the first part, you know what is delta U because you know E and the average, and you use the Q.
Yeah, so yeah, you can manipulate this expression. If you minus the variance of this thing, then you get this leftover term here.
I guess this is non-trivial because the derivative of the operator doesn't commute with the operator.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, so of course if these two commute, then this integral vanishes and you just get the usual thing here. Okay, so this is a first sort of example of where quantum mechanics comes into this, corrections come into this strong coupling regime. And in fact, there's lots of papers showing that this can actually be negative, so that you get these anomalies where the system's energy actually decreases as you heat it up. And this occurs around at low temperatures. So at low temperatures, this term dominates. And this thing is also not generally a positive operator, so this dissipation term can also be negative. So that you can get situations where this whole thing becomes negative.
But that would lead to a thermodynamic instability, right? If this were a real system.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's... Yeah.
I don't agree. No, it's still stable. The whole thing is in thermal equilibrium. Mm.
What does instable and unstable mean in that situation?
Yeah.
It means it wants to suck energy out of the bath and keep heating.
Exactly. Mark the internet. Right. So if this were a physical fact, this exact phenomenon would take place. Okay.
So what would be the consequence of having this negative heat capacity for thermal equilibrium?
I'm not so sure yet. Yeah, I mean, well, in
the sign of the thing, you have this inequality information that then has to be negative.
Yeah, but it's when I get to it later, it's balanced out by this term. So it's always, it doesn't violate that.
Okay.
You'll see it.
Yeah, the expression, yes.
Maybe you can give official information. I guess we need to stop in there.
So I'll show you. So I'll get to the final point over here, which is this uncertainty relation, which sort of connects all of these things together. So yeah, I think the main point is the total heat capacity is always positive, right? The composite thing, so it's always gonna, it's not gonna be unstable because the whole thing is still in canonical equilibrium, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you get negative heat capacities in the microeconomic ensemble and other situations. So. Right, so we can actually apply these ideas to thermometry. So the idea we have now is suppose we use our system as a thermometer. So we want to probe the temperature of the reservoir or the bath, but we only have access to the system. So it turns out the standard setup for this is through the Fisher information. So I'll try and explain this. So we have system and bath, but we want to, so the system depends on temperature of the bath, right? But it might be strongly coupled. How can we infer the temperature of the system, of the bath through the system? Well, we take some P of the M, perform it on the system, and we record the data, and we can optimize our experiment over all P of the Ms. Okay, so maybe I should write this a bit more formally. So we construct, depending on our choice of P of the M, we'll have some conditional probability dependent on the temperature. So let's say our P of the M's are like this. So
Okay, so we have a set of operators that we choose. And when we act these on the system, we get some distribution dependent on the temperature. And then we construct.
Sorry, what is now the temperature?
It's the temperature of the total.
So you still assume that the full thing is.
Yeah, so this is all in. In global
equilibrium. And you want to sort of learn about this global temperature and looking just at this.
Yeah. So normally you, in this situation, you assume weak coupling and you bring in a thermometer, you let it reach equilibrium and then you read off the data from the thermometer. But now we're saying, let's do the same thing, but now let it strongly interact, right? So it's going to be, actually, the thermometer is going to be in one of these states over here.
Right, except for those strongly interacting, there is an additional super bath. Because the full thing is in a thermal state.
Yeah, but like, for example, in the in Brownian motion, you can just take some state of the thermometer uncoupled to a canonical bath, turn on the interaction, and it will eventually reach this as a steady state without a super bath involved. So,
okay. Let's discuss this.
But yeah, you can include a super bath. Okay, so in metrology, we take our PVM, we construct a function that maps our outcomes onto some estimate. So this is the estimated temperature, and it's a random variable with this probability. So it's going to have an uncertainty attached to it, depending on how we choose the PVM. So that's just, we add another condition that our measurement scheme is unbiased or locally unbiased. So we assume that we have a thermometer that, on average, gives us the right result. We can actually relax this condition to sort of more weaker requirements. So this is where this notion of uncertainty in temperature comes from. So it's dependent on how we measure the actual system. So we use a thing known as the Kramer-Rao bound to find out what the optimal uncertainty is over all measurements that we can do. So what we find is delta beta, sorry, I'll put this as a variance, is always greater than the Fisher information. So the Fisher information is a function of the state alone, so it doesn't depend on the actual P of the app. This is the quantum Fisher information. This basically tells us what's the best thing we could do, what's the best measurement scheme we could construct. And this thing is defined as follows. So remember, we have our strongly coupled state here, so it's an expectation value. over a set of operators here, which are defined through an operator equation. Okay, so I mean, I don't want to go into too many details, but essentially, to compute the Fisher information, you have to solve this equation and find out what these operators are. And you can plug this in, and this tells you what the ultimate estimation of temperature.
I'm confused about what problem you're trying to solve. I would have done this in the following way. I mean, and the thermometer on the wall works because we believe the thermometer has some physical property that's related to its total energy, which it gets from coupling to the air in the room. So I would have computed the expectation value of HS in the global Gibbs state.
Yep.
Assuming I have the ability, I know everything about the Hamiltonian interaction and everything else, I would have plotted that as a function of beta,
And then I would, you know, measure that energy. And,
right.
And, okay. And then I would be done. Okay. But I wouldn't need Fisher information. I wouldn't need all this stuff. So why do you need all that? What are you doing that's different than that, and why do you need it?
First of all, we're saying we can't measure the total energy of everything.
No.
You're measuring HS, but you have to know HS.
Right. Right. So you must be assuming you don't know some things. So I'm not sure what you're assuming you don't know.
Okay, so we're saying on average we get the right temperature, right? And it turns out you, in the at least in the weak coupling case, you do measure energy. But you wanna construct. So obviously to get that you need to do an infinite number of measurements, right? To get an accurate.
I think you're talking about.
Yeah.
So I think you're saying you want to measure the energy HS,
yeah.
At local state, and that gives you a way to estimate the temperature.
That doesn't mean
to
best.
But
right.
You would have to do many, many measurements to actually get the statistics. Then you get an estimate of your temperature, and that's fine. But this here is theory about how to optimally measure something without assuming what HS is. So this is a general method. I mean, it goes back to actually when were the first papers published on this estimation theory? So this is very general about optimally measuring a parameter. Doing anything you could on the system, so you could measure the energy or anything else.
I think the key point is you described the way of measuring temperature, but we want to optimize our uncertainty in our estimate over
Okay, but the only uncertainty in my estimate is going to come from fluctuations in the energy of the system. So you're assuming the system is small enough that I have to worry about fluctuations in the energy.
I mean, that's fine. Yeah, so the...
Okay, so you want to measure, you want to find something better about the system to measure that will minimize those fluctuations.
Yeah, so I mean, you're right, it turns out...
Very different than energy.
Yeah, so in the weak coupling case, energy is the thing you measure. So in this Kramer-Rao bound, the thing that saturates this inequality is by doing energy measurements. What I'm going to show now is in the strong coupling case, you need to measure a different thing.
You are speaking with the idea of ensembles, so you are not talking about time. So you are imagining that you have an infinite number of copies of the same thermometer.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's an asymptotic
time coming to this place.
There's no, you're letting it thermalize, right? So you've got to wait for everything to reach equilibrium. But I mean, that's going to depend on the situation.
So if time comes, it's infinite.
Yeah, T is infinite.
Let me also comment here. So you're assuming idealized measurements on system observables, right? Mm-hmm. And so all you need to do this is just to reduce system state.
Yes.
So you don't need any of this effective mean force Hamiltonian to calculate.
That's right, for this part, yes.
But do you need to know what the interaction is?
Essentially, yes. Okay. You're going to need to know, because you essentially. So the way
you can't do it.
No, but so the you want to measure it. It turns out to saturate this, you need to measure in the basis of these operators, and to compute these operators, you need to solve this equation, which means you need the interaction because you need to know how this depends on temperature.
One other issue, I guess, is that when you're trying to measure a bare system operator, but that system is strongly coupled to something else. So practically, that's an extremely challenging demand for experimentalists to do.
Yes.
That's a comment.
So we have an example on Janet's slides of what this mean force Hamiltonian looks like, and you can sometimes get situations where you can come up with quantities that you can compute and measure. But I don't want to go into too many examples, really. But the key thing we have here is we prove that the Fisher information is less than variance in energy minus the skew information. Okay. So this is something that we prove in the paper, and if you combine that with this thing, then we get this uncertainty relation here. So we find out what the optimal uncertainty is, and it's Right, so this is the main result. So as Janet was mentioning, the original uncertainty relation that people have derived since, I think it goes back to 40s or 50s, was this one here. So so this is why, this is what you're saying. So in the classical case, the weak coupling case, the optimal measurements are energy measurements, and you saturate this thing by, so measuring energy. But what we find here in the quantum case is we get a tighter inequality related to the fact that this operator no longer commutes with the system. So this skew information now constrains our ability to measure the temperature. So I've shown two examples of where this skew information comes into strong coupling. So it modifies the heat capacity and it modifies the achievable fluctuations in temperature.
So it makes it worse.
Exactly.
It makes it worse.
I guess, I don't know how you quantify worse, though.
Uncertainty in temperature
is bigger,
right? You want to minimize your temperature uncertainty.
Yes, but this depends on interaction as well.
It
shows how coherence affects it, but it isn't. To answer whether it's worse, you'd have to find out the trade-off between these two quantities and how they scale with like low temperatures.
As a function of interactions.
Which is an open question, really.
But it can be, in specific cases, can be much better.
So I think the key thing to prove in the future would be how these two things scale at low temperatures. Because obviously at low temperatures, this thing is going to become really large. So the main issue with low temperature thermometry is in the weak coupling case, it becomes exponentially inefficient. But it turns out you can find examples where strong coupling gives better scaling at low temperatures. And so it's going to, I mean, this has still not been shown in concrete way, but this is going to be related to the coherences in this term. In Lewis's paper, they found better sub-exponential scaling at low temperature in the Brownian oscillator example, right? And this stems from the strong interaction. But I don't exactly know how this was related to coherence.
It's related to the spectrum of the global Hamiltonian. It's a gapless system. Even when you do local thermometry, you get this polynomial scaling of the official information with temperature. But if it's a gap, if you have a gap system, because you have this finite gap, you get an exponentially inefficient low temperature thermometer. You get a bound that goes exponentially fast to zero as you send the temperature to zero. You get millibar
scale, but this because your global system is gapped.
Make it gapless, then you get better scale.
Yes.
But it doesn't really have to do with the state,
it has to do with the Hamiltonian. So just a question to understand better. So this Q that appears there, is that because quantum strong or both of them together?
It's both of them together. Because if the interaction is weak, then these two things will commute. Right.
Okay. Interacting strong and the system is classical, this Q will
vanish, yes. But we also get a classical correction. So this is the second part of the result that we can use from here. So remember over here the heat capacity also has this term here. So if we choose to measure temperature instead of inverse temperature, we can actually get a similar result. So if we look at the optimal signal-to-noise ratio of estimating T, then we find that this is less than the heat capacity minus this additional term. Okay, so in the weak coupling case, the original result says that the signal-to-noise ratio is always restricted by the heat capacity. So the best thermometers are ones with a high heat capacity. But what we find here in the strong coupling case is we have an additional
dissipation term, which still persists even if everything commutes. So there's additional factors to optimize over if you want to design a strongly coupled thermometer.
So this Q will be, I can repeat this strong coupling part of the network just with using Hamiltonians, which are functions of phase space and do this classically, no?
Yes.
So when I find Q equals zero in that case, even though maybe it was some bracket of your H with your density, Eugene density may not be zero.
Yeah. It's a completely quantum term. It will vanish if everything commutes.
It's because of that formula that of the exponential, I guess.
No? Yes. So I guess the classical corrections show up in the bearings, because now you have the bearings of this operator over here, which is why you get this additional term. But, yeah.
Hey, Harry, I'd like to understand something that would also come up in Louise's talk. So you both say to build the best thermometer, you need a really big heat capacity, right? But when I talk to all my experimentalist friends, they say, no, you want to do the opposite. You want a very, very small heat capacity thing. Because when you start measuring that's going to alter the temperature of the thing you're measuring, right? So you can imagine that your system is really much bigger than your bath, and you have a huge heat capacity, you simply suck all the heat out of the bath and you change the temperature. So is there any way to kind of account for that kind of physical back action in this problem?
So you want both things, no? Like if you have a finite dimensional system, the capacity is limited. So you cannot have more than some amount of capacity. And you would say you have finite dimension in your thermometer, so you want to build it.
So there's an implicit assumption that it's still very much, much smaller than the capacity of the environment.
Yeah, this is all, assuming finite.
However, in strong coupling, you also perturb the environment. So this is.
Exactly.
This is.
I want to state that. Similar issue. I say the issue is how fast can you measure the temperature, really, to put us some time scale. This would be more interesting to see because this is infinite time. So let's say I want to measure finite time, what would be the strategy? Then for sure you wouldn't use infinite heat capacity because you would never get there.
Yeah, so this is
your experimentalists are impatient. They want to measure in their lifetime.
Then shall we wrap it up? Because it's almost 12.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So